Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Hi, this is Daniel LaRue of the Real GM Radio Podcast, and I'm taking the New Orleans Saints over the Seattle Seahawks in their Monday night matchup. BetOnline has free odds and lines available online or on your mobile device. Visit betonline.net today.
It used to be hard to find the exact auto parts you needed, and that meant spending a lot of time at swap meets. It's a different game now when you can order exactly what you need from eBay Motors. They have 122 million parts, so you can always find the right fitment. Spend less time searching and more time building with the eBay Motors app, or visit ebaymotors.com. Let's ride.
Well, good news. Jay Leno is in studio for a nice long interview. But first, there's Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the holidays are right around the corner. Before you know it, turkeys will be stuffed, and that fat guy with a white beard will be breaking into your homes in the middle of the night. Don't wait until the last minute to treat yourself or the people you love in life to marvelous Christmas presents like the Carolla Christmas Card Combo. This three-bottle gift set comes with a jolly Christmas card featuring and signed by each and every person that makes this the greatest podcart in the universe. So head to CorollaDrinks.com today. Get your Carolla Christmas Card Combo for only $60. That's three bottles of your choice, plus a Christmas card signed by the entire staff for only $60. Happy holidays from everyone at Carolla Drinks.
Well, here with the great Jay Leno, the game show. It's a new game show. Well, it's an old game show that Jay brought back. You Bet Your Life. It airs now, and you can go to youbetyourlife.com for local listings. Got his old band leader, Kevin Eubanks, back. And back with the old, well, what's old is new again, as they say. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you.
I was talking about you the other day because I did a show with Jay out at Brea, and everyone was so impressed by who you were and just how you hit the ground running. You know, I said when Jay got on the stage at the comedy club, it was like a marlin in the open sea. It just felt like where he should be.
Well, like a whale in the open sea is probably
you walked out on stage and I could just feel it wash over the audience and me.
Well, you should always have a joke to open. You know, I hate that when you go to how's everybody doing? Anybody Denver? Woo, Denver! Boston! Yeah, Boston! Yeah, tell a joke!
I'm with you in the sense that when you see guys and they're trying to get 15, 20 minutes of stage time and they're doing crowd work.
Right.
It's sort of like, I mean, I'm not a comedian snob, but I'm like, didn't you come out here to work out some material?
Right.
Why are you doing crowd work?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, but I did also note, and I remember this very clearly, and it's made me a little insecure over the years, but I said to Jay once, geez, I carry around these buck slips because I say something, I think of something, I forget about it immediately. I got to write it down all the time.
Right.
And Jay said, well, if it's funny, you'll remember it. And I thought, no, I won't. Like, I forget stuff. And then I realized, talking to you about cars and motorcycles – and then hearing you pull all these jokes out one after the other, I think you have a photographic memory.
No, I don't. First of all, there's no such thing as a photographic memory. Do you know that?
I couldn't remember that.
There's no proof that there's such a thing as a photograph.
Well, what we would call, what people would say is a photographic memory.
Well, you know what? I think as a comic, things that it makes a notch in your mind. You know, I always tell this story, but the first joke I ever told, I remember being in the fourth grade and Mrs. Allen, who I still see, by the way, because when I was like 9, she was like 22 as a teacher.
Right.
But I thought she was like 60 at the time. You know, okay. So when I go back to my hometown, she's like 88 or something now, you know, but we're still friends. But she was talking about Robin Hood, you know, and that Robin Hood, and she said the sheriff of Nottingham, how cruel he was, and he wouldn't, when he captured Robin's men, he would boil them in oil. And I put my hand up and I said, do you know why he did that to Tuck? And she said, no, why? Because he was a friar.
Right.
And she went, all right, that's not funny. But then I said, ooh, then I noticed she smiled, you know.
Right.
So okay. So then later, and class breaks, you know, so we'll go through a couple of periods. I'm walking down the hall. One of the teachers comes down, Leno, come here. What was he said? Something about Robin. What? Mrs. Allen said he said something. Friar. Oh, Friar, that's what I was thinking. I went, ooh, she went back and repeated my joke.
Oh, you
know?
Yeah.
So I always remember, you know, I think as a comic, you instinctively remember the stuff that gets a laugh, the stuff that's really funny.
But that is true. But as somebody who knows a lot about cars, and then to hear what you know about cars, there's a lot of information out there on, and again, you know, sometimes you meet car guys and they're Mopar guys and they just know everything about.
Right. Yeah. Those guys are always very funny.
They're always a delight. Super funny. Yeah. Those guys, oh, they just know this thing. They have their niche.
And they know nothing about other cars. You know how the guy came out who was a Hemi guy. Oh, your Hemi. Your Hemi was built on a Thursday by a guy named George Johansson.
Right.
And he had been sick on Friday, but he came in the fall, and they'll tell you all that. Then he says to me, what's that car over there? That's a Duesenberg. Oh, is it German? No, it's American. You never heard? No. You never heard of a Duesenberg. That's all he knew were Hemis, you know.
I completely agree, and I sort of look at it as – I always kind of liken it to the guys who claim they love women but just redheads. And I'm like, why? Either if you love women, there's a lot more than that.
Right.
And I think Jay's a lover of all cars.
Yeah, I think it rolls, explodes, and makes noise. I think it's a fair
– But – And again, I'm not going to force you into claiming the mantle of photographic memory or whatever the version of that is, but you do have at your fingertips so much information about
many different cars.
Useless
knowledge. You know, the
I get it.
Like, give an example. I had a Ford guy. We were testing the new Mach 1 Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief engineer from Ford kind of knew everything about it. And he was talking about the horse logo.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, do you know the one in the front? You know where that's from? And you go, well, he just went and he said, no. And there was a guy named, it began with a K, Canarsis, something like that. He was a designer from Ford. And
mm-hmm.
he was in the 1938 Olympics as an equestrian. And then World War II started. Then, since he was an equestrian, he got drafted into the Cavalry Corps. Okay. He got in the Cavalry Corps. His commanding officer was killed. And since he was a leading equestrian, he was made commanding officer, and he led the last charge on horseback in modern warfare against tanks.
Wow.
Everybody got blown up. He's got a sword, and they're charging at tanks.
Right.
These guys just get blown away. Anyway, the war ends. He comes to America. He becomes a designer for Ford,
mm-hmm.
and he designs this horse, which is an homage to the horse he rode in that last cavalry charge. Now, the reason he never heard about this, he was on the other side.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he was on the German side. And he got his ass kicked by American tanks. But you think, oh, man, what a story. Imagine a guy with a sword charging a tank. You know,
right.
Guys are blown up, and you're just still charging that tank. And you think, what a oh, he's on the other side. Oh, it's like, well, he emigrated to America. So that's why you never heard the story.
Did it just popped in my head that you brought up a Duesenberg. I know you drove your Tesla Plaid here with the yoke and the crazy 0-60, 0-100 quarter mile time speed up at Laguna Seca. I mean, the stats are mind numbing on that car.
But
I was thinking about, you know, some of life is kind of luck. You know, like what era you're in. You know, you weren't 18 when World War II broke out.
Right.
And that's good because you may have been on a horse charging a tank.
Right, right.
And there's plagues and there's poverty and there's stuff. But it seems to me like you with the Duesenberg on one side of the garage and the Tesla Plaid on the other – seems like a good era to be born into because
you
have this crazy technology and then all this amazing, whatever the Tesla of the past was from the 20s
and 30s. Well, actually, the best time to be born is probably the year 1900. mm-hmm. because you grow up in an agricultural society. Then the Wright brothers come along. Then Lindbergh comes along. And then we walk on the moon all within your lifetime.
Right.
I mean, Lindbergh saw us walk on the moon. Did you know that?
Yeah.
He died in 71, I think.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you flew across the ocean. That was, oh, my God. It was like going, oh, my God, the whole world celebrate. You're the most popular figure in the world for just flying to France.
Right.
Which seems so, I think that's the most amazing era to live in. Because now you expect stuff. You know, do you ever watch Breaking Bad? Mm-hmm. Did you watch the whole series?
I haven't watched every one.
But my favorite line was when Aaron Paul's character, this is a stupid, the meth head kid, he and Walter White are trapped. The cops are coming. And he goes, can't you just like make a robot or something and get us out of here? He goes, well, I'm the scientist. I can't. Can you just make a robot? But now we live in an era where people just expect stuff to.
Mm-hmm.
We're disappointed when it doesn't do this.
Right.
You know, as opposed to an era with, what, you mean you went to the moon? What, that's not possible. Now we're, well, yeah, moon's okay, but how about Mars? Why aren't we in Mars yet? I mean, now you just expect it to happen.
Yeah. When I was growing up, if I got into a car with air conditioning, it was miraculous. Oh, yeah. And now if my kids get into a car that doesn't have air conditioning, yeah, they're pissed. And that's,
well, we used to do that. You know, when I was a kid, it got so humid around Hampton Beach, around New Hampshire and Salisbury Beach, Massachusetts. So what we go up my dad's car, which did not have air conditioning. We'd roll out the windows. We'd roll our sleeves down, and we'd put jackets on, right, and drive around. Hey, girls, you want a cool girl? The girls would look at it. He's got air conditioning. Yeah. And then they'd get in there. Hey, no air in this car. No. It just broke. We'd meet women who would be hugely disappointed when we didn't have air. We just looked like we had air conditioning. We looked like guys with air conditioning.
Did you, we know when you were nine that, yes, that's a very real moment where you know the teacher who may have not really cracked in front of you, but repeated your joke to
right.
another member of the
right.
faculty. That's one of those little kind of watershed, sounds like nothing but means something moments. Was it that point on, did you know comedy was in the future?
No, not really. But I knew what got a reaction from a, I never knew the power of words. I remember once when I was a kid, we would have the adults table and the children's table.
Mm-hmm.
And one day my Uncle Lou, we would have Sunday dinner with all the relatives. And I said to my Uncle Lou was the bachelor of the family, And my mother said, how's that lovely Louise, Lou? Are you still seeing her? And he said, no, I'm not seeing her anymore. And my mom said, why not? And Lou said, she's frigid. I saw my mother just look furious. I'm like, what was that? And I saw everybody, my dad kind of laugh, And I go, what's all about, So after that dinner, if I could get a dictionary, look up frigid, frozen, frozen to death or something.
Right.
So the next week, Lou was at dinner, and I said, I'm sorry to hear about Louise. And Lou said, well, what'd you hear? Well, I guess she froze to death, right? She died? I said, what do you mean she froze to death? Like, didn't she freeze to death? My mother said, what do you mean? What do you think she froze to death? Well, last week, Uncle Lou said she was frigid. And my dad, all the guys at the table, my mother. That was the day they invented the children's table. From that point on, I was now
Genesis.
Sitting over in the other room, literally in the kitchen at the table where the adults had dinner. But yeah, I just always remember that because it got a reaction from adults. So I've always been able to remember things that were said that got a reaction that was different from what normally would happen.
Working with people in this business can be a pain in the butt sometimes, not with Mr. Leno. He's always early. He's always ready to go. And I see the way you interact with your fans, and I see the way you comport and conduct yourself, I should say. But do you think of yourself as a pleaser?
Yeah, I guess I am. I think so. I would take a lot of heat for that, but I mean, that's your job as a performer. I mean, you're there to make people laugh, I guess, or at least give it a shot. But I do. I, 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 you know, I'm a huge believer in low self-esteem. I think it's the key to success. You know,
yeah.
If you don't think you're the smartest person in the room, you'll listen and pay attention. Like when I got the Tonight Show, I just hired what I thought were the best lighting people, best producer, best director. And I just let them do their job. I never interfered. I never said, well, hold on. Hang on. I think we need more of this light over here because it's not my area. You guys do what you do. And it worked out fine. We had the same people for 22 years and we were number one for 20 of the years. And that was cool. And that was fine. I never felt I had to stick my nose in, you know.
Well, you know, something that I always took note of when I would do your show back in the day is we'd be running through rehearsal and then one of your head writers or producer would say, like, hey, Jay, don't do it this way. Do it the other way. It's funnier that way. And you'd go, oh, all right, which sounds like it makes sense because you hired the guy and he's right. funny and he's right. giving you some constructive criticism or note or whatever. But a lot of guys that wouldn't sit right with, I feel like a lot of people
I always wonder under the premise that anybody can pull the cord and stop the train, which causes problems sometimes, but it keeps it real. Like, what was wrong with tonight's show? You sucked. Oh, okay. Okay, I sucked tonight. It's easier than taking a week and analyzing it. No, I just sucked tonight. I mean, you have to be able to do that. That's the easiest way to get through. Plus, when people feel like they're a part of something, they're contributing. When an intern can say, I don't get that. I don't think it's funny. Oh, okay. Why? And if it's sometimes it's a valid reason, sometimes it's totally not. But just the fact that they get to contribute, now they feel like they're part of the show. You know, my favorite scene in the Godfather movie, I think it was Godfather 2, where he goes to Cuba and he sees the guy blow himself up so he could kill the two policemen.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, when your own troops are willing to die to take you down, that's when it's over. And that's what I see happen in TV all the time. People got a show. Oh, and the writers and the other people, they hate him so much. They actually don't care if they lose their job as long as he or she loses her job. And
right.
that's usually what happens, you know. So I was always very cognizant of that fact. So he always had a pretty good crew, you know.
Yeah, and a happy crew.
And a happy crew. I mean, when I was – well, I'm blowing my own horn here. But when I was doing The Tonight Show, I was making $30 million a year. It was ridiculous. Okay. And NBC said, well, we're going to have to cut half the crew, you know. So we had a big meeting. I said, all right, but show of hands, how many feel I should take a 50% pay cut so we can keep everybody? Well, I got outvoted. And I said, well, I got screwed on that one. But really, I already have $15 million. I'm doing pretty good. You know, I never thought I'd get this far. And you know something? They were the best crew for the rest of the days. You know, everything was always terrific. It was a union crew. Everybody made a good living. You know, guys would come up and show me the car they bought or the house they got around the corner or whatever it might be. And it didn't cost me anything, really, because I had plenty of money. I was making plenty of money.
What year did you take the haircut from 30 to 15?
It was in the 2000s, maybe 2005 from that point on, I think.
The legend is that you always kept all those Tonight Show checks made your money doing live performances and corporate things and stuff like that.
Yeah, you got to be hungry. I used to live week to week.
Did you literally just put those checks, you know, in the bank and never
cash? I lived on the money I made as a stand-up, yeah. I wanted to be a comedian. I never thought TV was a job that would last your
whole
life.
How many years did you do that?
Till the very end. I never touched any of it. I always worked.
So
I was doing 210 dates a year.
No, I know what you can get paid if you go out and you sprinkle some corporate gigs in there. There's money to be made.
Oh yeah.
But you still have a pretty big nut. You have guys who work for you. You purchase a car every once in a while.
Yeah.
Fly sort of private. In that you have to refuel in Muncie, Indiana every once in a while. Can't get all the way across the country. But that money just went into an account?
Yeah, still there.
Still there.
Yeah.
And so what do you think of this? So it's not urban legend that that's what you did.
No, but I mean, I don't have girlfriends and cocaine habits and stuff like that, you know. So you could save a tremendous amount of money.
How do you reconcile the sort of comedic mind with the mechanical mind? Because it's not a – it seems like it's not a coincidence to me that most – the comedians I know – have zero sort of tangible life skills. You know, they seem to be fairly inept, but also mainly just not interested in cars and construction and mechanics. And I sort of have you pegged as kind of a mechanical guy, even more than a car guy.
Well, you know, that's not really true. I mean, Tim Allen very much that way.
Well, you can find exceptions, saying, like, by and large.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Most of those guys aren't going to change a head.
Well, it's a genetic flaw that makes you a comedian. It's not a plus. We just happen to live in an era when it pays dividends. I mean, if this was the Crusades, it would be, why are the soldiers laughing? Who's making them laugh? Kill that guy, you know, and that's because he's annoying. Just kill that guy. Just kill him right now because they're not paying attention. But we live in a time now where now it happens to pay very good dividends. So that's pretty lucky. But I mean, I find most comedians either just off the wall, drunk, cokeheads, crazy, or complete abstain. I rarely find anybody in the middle. You know, don't you find that to be true too?
Yeah, I mean. Comedians, maybe there's something to the fact that they're trying to construct and connect things all the time in their head. I recently had a person say to me when I said, I get home, I just want to watch TV. I watch. And people say, what do you watch? I go, old episode of Starsky and Hutch. And they go, why? And I go, because I just want to sit there. And the person said, that's because your brain is trying to connect things all day, and then you get home and you don't want to connect things. But I'm wondering if sometimes comedians think a little too much. I mean, you.
Well, I think this is a silly saying, but the heart is healthiest when the head and the hands work together. Mm-hmm. I go to the garage and work on stuff all day. Okay, you know, you take the transmission out and you smell awful and you keep washing your hands with Brillo pads and then you realize a guy made $80 for doing that for the day. Then you stand on stage and tell a joke. Oh, this is such an easy way to make money. I've only been up here 4 minutes. I already made back the 80. You know?
Well, is that – I have the same feeling. It's a kind of blue-collar mentality, which is when people – people accuse me of working a lot, and I go, what do you mean working a lot? And they go, yeah, you got to go, and you do a bunch of podcasts, and you go to a show that night, and I go, that's not work.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the same way.
Roofing is working.
Yeah, roofing. Being a roofer is the worst job.
You got to be in the sun. And they're like, no, but you work, then you go out of town, then you write a book. And I always go, but it doesn't – they're trying to convince me it's work. It doesn't really feel like work.
No, it's not work.
But maybe you need a kind of blue-collar base – to have that to be calibrated?
Well, I have a pool that I've never – but not never been in. I have a house in Beverly Hills. I went in the pool in 89 to fix the light. That was the last time. Because every time I get near the pool – I get like 10 feet to the pool and I hear that Boston voice. Wait, big shot, where you sit in the pool in Beverly Hills? Is that what you do now, huh? You got nothing broken here? Huh? You got nothing you got to fix, really? Where you going? Where you a trust fund baby? You going to sit in the pool? There you going to do float around? No, I'm not going to go. I mean, I can't bring myself to get in the pool. I get near it. I put my hand in it. Oh, it seems okay. And then I rationalize. I go, okay, I get in the pool. Now I'm wet. Now what? You know, so I can't. So I go back and then I find something to do. And, you know, Seinfeld and I used to have this discussion all the time. You know, we were both young comics and we were doing like 250 dates a year. We used to say, what if we went on vacation and we liked it? Then we're screwed. Mm-hmm. Then we're really screwed. So let's not ever go on vacation because we might like it. And then what? Oh, man.
What is a normal day for you when you're not, you know, doing You Bet Your Life or, you know, some specialty corporate thing or gig or something?
I try to do something every day, but I go to the garage. I work on stuff or I help my wife with stuff and.
You get up and head into the warehouse every day?
Yeah, every day. That's always something. I mean, if I do one oil change a day, that takes a year and a half. You know, so, okay. Today I changed the oil on a 1927 Model X Duesenberg. So I finished. That's where I just came from. So.
Do you have something out there car-wise? Because I think a lot of guys go out and they pursue cars. You know, they go to auctions. I know you don't buy cars at auctions. But they're guys, they go, I want this car. And then they go out and they pursue it, you know?
No, I
feel like
that.
Cars kind of come, not to give them to you, but I just mean, I don't feel you out chasing cars.
No, I buy the story as much as I like. Cars that have great stories are always fascinating to me, you know?
And I know, like, Jay will tell the story, but if you go to Jay's shop, he'll walk past a lot of the Duesenbergs and a lot of the Lamborghini Muras and a lot of the AC Shelby Cobras, and he'll get to this little three-wheel handmade buggy, that was based on a motorcycle, as a motorcycle engine in it. And then he'll walk you over there, and then he'll tell you the story of that guy, that trike. I think it's a three-wheel. And the story behind it, even though it's the least recognizable, maybe the least sexy, and maybe the least valuable out of all the cars, but it's got the best story.
It's also got a good story. You know, I have this Duesenberg, the LeBaron barrel side, and the first owner got it when he was 17 years old. His grandfather died.
What year was that, approximately?
That was in 28.
Were they out of Indiana?
Yeah, all Duesenbergs were built in 1928.
Oh, all in all one year?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
They were going to build 500 a year. Then the Depression came, and it took 10 years to sell the first 484 that they had finished.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this guy, his grandfather left him $17,000 in stock. So he and the grandfather go down to the Duesenberg showroom. They buy this Duesenberg for $17,500. They drive it home. The kid's father, the son of the grandfather, furious that the grandfather wasted the stock on the stupid car. Threw them both out of the house, just furious over that. Then, of course, the Depression hit, and the stock was useless now, but he had the car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He had the car. He sold it to a guy who was one of the first GIs into Berlin. And this guy, with four other guys, raided a bunch of German banks, busted open savings deposit box, didn't take cash because that was useless, but took diamonds and gold. Then they bought an old motorcycle. They cut it open. They buried all the diamonds and the gold in the frame of the motorcycle, welded it back up, left the motorcycle with the motorcycle dealer in Germany, gave him some money. He said, we're going to come back in a year and pick this up. They said, fine. Went back in a year, imported the motorcycle, cut it open, took out the diamonds, bought the Duesenberg from Ashton and a huge estate in Connecticut. You know. Then the guy got despondent over a woman within a year bringing it in. Drove the car into the barn, left it running, and died in the car. And the car sat from 1948 until 1988 when I got it. And I got it from his brother. But his brother would never sell it to anybody that knew the story of his brother. You know, Duesenberg, hey, I heard your brother died in the car. We'd like to buy. No, it's not for sale. It's not for sale. So I was at a motorcycle meet, and I was talking to this old guy. And he was, you know, Duesenberg, you ever heard? I said, yeah. And I gave him some, you know, useless Duesenberg facts, and he seemed very impressed. He goes, would you ever want to buy one if one came available? I said, yeah, you can't buy them. There aren't any around. He goes, well, I got one, and I'll sell it. Okay. So I bought it never knowing the story. It wasn't until after I got it, I heard from all the Duesenberg collectors who didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was an interesting story. I have another Duesenberg that was owned by Strauss that owned Macy's, and he bought it in 1929. And he parked it in a garage in downtown Manhattan in 1931. And it sat there until 2005 in the same space in the garage. Well, there was always a rumor that there was a Duesenberg in a parking garage somewhere in New York. So I'm not a New York guy. So my wife wanted to go to New York. Because you go shopping, I'm going to hit every parking garage. So I go down the village. I go east, west, just hitting every parking garage.
Just looking to see if you can see it.
Any old cars? Say, oh, yeah, old car. Oh, it's a Falcon. Oh, it's a, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I get to West 57th Street. Any old cars? Yeah, there's an old Duesenberg or something in a Rolls Royce. There it is. There's the car. It's been parked there all those years. I mean, the roof had collapsed because there was a hole in the roof of the garage. They owed a ton of money on the rent, like $80,000 in back storage
fees. The parking.
For the parking, yeah. And so I asked, is it for sale? And the guy says, well, they haven't paid us, so we're going to have an auction. I said, well, let me know what is our auction. I bid on it, and I got it, you know. And we dragged it out of the parking garage where it had been sat since 1931.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. Imagine a treasure like that buried in New York City, you know.
Yeah, and like I said, most car guys have some sort of car that's kind of commensurate with whatever tax bracket they're currently in. And they kind of, as they move up in tax brackets, they go, oh, well, now I want this car. But I've never, and also if you, also most guys kind of declare a major. We talked about the Mopar guys, and there's right, other right, guys that are American muscle guys, right. And there's the Japanese car guys, and I like Paul Newman race cars, so there's a theme or something.
Right, right.
But you just like cars and stories and the story behind the car.
I just like the stories. I like noble failures. I like cars that were ahead of their time, in their time. Duesenberg was like that. It was ridiculously expensive. Nobody – I have a car called a my Will Sinclair. A guy named C. Harold Wills was Henry Ford's first employee. And he and Henry Ford agreed to split everything 50-50. Ford was not a cheapskate, but he didn't like to give credit. Mm-hmm. And Wills was the guy who invented the Ford logo. You know, they mm-hmm. still use today the blue oval, planetary transmission, a bunch of stuff. And he always coming up with great ideas. And he, like everybody else who worked with Henry Ford, they fought. And he took his millions of dollars worth of stock that he had by 1912. And started the Will Sinclair Car Company. And he built an overhead cam V8 bevel drive. I'm a very sophisticated motor. And Henry Ford said, nobody wants to go 70 miles an hour. Believe me, you're not going to sell this thing. Oh, no, I'm not going to sell. And it was going to be a reasonable price car. By the time he finished, it was very expensive. It was close to $4,000 when a Model T was $260. And they sold 12,000 of them. But at that rate, again, depression hit and then went out of business. And so to find one of those is pretty rare. There's only about 80 of them left in the world. But I managed to find one in a storage container down in San Diego. You know, people – I just hear from people who have old cars. And when I heard Will Sinclair, yeah. So I went down to look at it, and there it was. So,
well, people have a thing with cars that is sort of unlike real estate or other things people sell, which right. is they want the car to go to the right place. Many people do. Not oh, yeah. all.
That is the reason. There are plenty of cars I've gotten because people know, A, I'm not going to flip it. Nobody wants to sell a car and then 2 weeks later saying, I'm going to bring a trailer for twice the money.
Right.
You know, I had – you talk about real estate. My wife and I, we used to live up on Del Zorro, and we had a house. And so when I was selling –
up in the Hollywood Hills.
Up in the Hollywood – when I was selling the house, we're asking – I can't remember, 300, something like that. And this woman shows up with a kid, single mom. And I said, oh, let's sell it to her. Let's give her a break. And I said, well, honey, we're knocking a lot of money. All right. So we knocked like 50 grand or whatever it was. This is before housing prices went crazy. Like, okay. And then Mara said – Let's get the drapes dry cleaned and stuff. I go, honey, we didn't dry clean the drapes when we lived here. Well, we're giving her, she's got a kid and it's going to be done. Oh, all right. So take the dry clean, go on strike again. Oh, so we sell her the house. And we feel pretty good about that. And about a month later, I said, let's go by and see how they. I get there just as the bulldozer, and I see my drapes being crushed. And I go, and what happened? Like, well, it turned out the woman worked for a realty company, and she was just
– flipping it?
Yeah. She goes with his kid and pretends
oh,
to be
– oh, interesting.
Yeah, with the sob story. And we felt for – I felt like the biggest rube.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Hilarious. I went, oh. But I remember just seeing – but my drapes, I just saw the bulldozer go just crunch them up in it. Oh, yeah. They just knocked it down and put some sort of Iranian palace in there.
So let's talk history with you.
History.
Yeah. When do you, I don't know. I mean, we talked about very early, making your dad laugh, making your teacher laugh.
Right.
When did you professionally kind of realize that's something you could do?
What's today? you know, I don't know. I guess, I don't know. I think you always have that doubt. You always think it's going to end tomorrow, which I think is good. You don't get that confident. I would say probably in the 80s, I guess, when I bought a house in Beverly Hills. I think, well, this is pretty good, you know. It was, my mother's from Scotland. It's very hard to impress my mother, you know. I remember when I first came here, I would try to impress my mother with show business tales. I remember I called her. Stallone had just gotten $10 million for 2 weeks' work for some movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my mom and told her this. And long pause. She goes, but what's he going to do the other 50 weeks? I mean, what if no other job comes in? What happens then? I said, yeah, you're right, Ma. You know, that's right. But you make $100 every week. You know, you got that $100 coming in rather than just get $10 million for 2 weeks' work. Yeah. I mean, yeah, so that's that. I guess I'm a product of having depression era present parents, rather. You know, my parents grew up during the Depression, so I never really thought I was. When I was a kid, I always had two jobs. I worked at Wilmington Ford and I worked at McDonald's, and I would either bank the Wilmington Ford money and spend the McDonald's money or vice versa. Then when I became a comedian, oh, okay, well, I could quit McDonald's, so I kept the other job. And then I spent the money I made as a comedian, banked the other one. But then, oh, I was making more money as a comedian. So, and then eventually I dropped the other job and just lived on being a comedian. And then when I got the Tonight Show, I went back to my old way of, okay, I'm going to bank that job,
mm-hmm.
and save that one, and live on what I make on this one, you know.
How much of, you know, when we always talk about it, but when I was working across the street from your house on Del Zorro back in the day and I was making $8 or $9 an hour, I just wanted more money and I was doing the math on construction and I knew I liked cars. And not only do you not make a lot of money in construction, but you have to drive a truck.
Right.
And that wasn't, you know, maybe there's a handful of sports cars out there. Maybe you get an MG or a Datsun 2000 right. Roadster or something like that. And if you have a job at a bank, you could still kind of drive a nifty car,
right.
even if you're making $11 an hour. But right. if you're making $11 an hour swinging a hammer, you need a truck.
Right.
And you don't have a second car and you live in an apartment. There's no place to park it. An apartment's not in a good neighborhood and it's going to get broken into and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of my motivation was I want cars. I want tools. I want a place, a warehouse to put the cars. And I was kind of motivated comedically because I wanted these things.
Right, right.
How much of that factored in for you?
I think there was some of that. I was very fortunate. I was always happy with whatever I had at the time. I always thought, well, this is pretty good. I'm getting paid to be I'm living on what I make as a comedian. Well, that's pretty good. I thought that was just unbelievable. I remember I was here in town. And I was dead broke, and I went down to the unemployment office, and I stood in line. And the woman said, did you look for a job this week? I said, not hard enough. No. I couldn't take the money. I couldn't take the money. I just couldn't do it. I got two legs. I got two arms. What am I doing? You know, no. I said, I'm going to be one of those guys. So I went out and, you know, tried to live on what I made as a comedian. And I was all able to live within my means. I bought a Vega for $100. It was an old piece of crap.
Chevy Vega was, it was one of the, it was kind of Chevy's version of a
Pinto.
Pinto, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
The
terrible car.
Japanese kind of came in, VW Bugs, I mean, before
right.
America, gas crunch, and everyone's, America said, we got to make a small car, and they didn't know how to make a small car.
But I was never a credit card guy. I always tried to live within my means.
Unless, by the way, it was a Cosworth Vega.
Well, no, it wasn't that.
In which case, you had a twin cam.
Yeah, the twin cam, and you only got 15 more horsepower.
Oh, really?
With all that Cosworth Vega.
I'm just bragging, letting you know I knew what a Cosworth
Vega
was.
I know, Cosworth Vega. By the time you were done with that, it cost almost as much as a Corvette. It was the most ridiculous car. There aren't many Cosworth Vegas. All it was is that sandcast block with an aluminum head with twin cams, and it gave maybe 15 more. I think it was 150 horse. And it wasn't anything. But it made the Vega like $4,200 when a Corvette was like $4,400.
So you had a $100 Vega.
Yeah.
What year are we talking about here?
Late 70s, early 80s.
And was it the Comedy Store where you kind of made your bones out here?
Yeah, the Comedy Store. Well, I started, you know, I was lucky. I started in New York and Boston. So when I got here, I had a bit of a reputation, at least in the comedy community. And I could, you know, I loved the Comedy Store in the early days, but Mitzi sort of had this thing where she, here's what I see you doing.
Right.
You know? Yeah, I always tell the story of, there's a great comedian named Jack Grayman. He was very funny. He was one of the Comedy Store regulars. And Mitzi said to him, I want you to be a Jackie Bananas. You wear like a yellow sport coat, you'd be Jackie Banana.
Mm-hmm.
And because she owned the club, and he had to, and I didn't want to take advice from somebody. I mean, she's very nice and had the club. I remember Seinfeld, too. Seinfeld was a well-established comic by the time he got here. And he would go to the comedy store. He just wanted to do a set. And Mitzi would give him advice and tell him what to do. And, hey, I just want to stand on the stage. So he never really was a Comedy Store guy. Mm-hmm. But I knew I only used it. You know, my attitude was always, when you get good somewhere, get out and go to the place where you're bad. Anybody can be good where they're good. Go mm-hmm. to the place where you're bad and where they don't like you. And that's what I think happened. There's a lot of great comics at the Comedy Store who just chose to live in Mitzi's apartment or stay at the comedy condo, whatever they had, and eat their meals at the club and get a free drink and do a set. And pretty soon they had Comedy Store acts. They had 20 minutes on the thing in the window and 10 minutes on this. And it would get big laughs, but as soon as you left the environment of the Comedy Store, nobody knew what you're talking about.
Who, I'll tease it, but who are some of the comedians that you really, current, older people we've heard of, that you really just said, that guy's got the goods or that gal's got the goods?
Well, Jim Carrey, unbelievable.
Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey, yeah. I mean,
as a stand-up or as a talent?
Well, as a stand-up who could do impressions, who could do – he did people nobody else did, and he did them in odd ways and different ways. Now, he was – well, still is. I mean, just brilliant, really good, really, really impressive. God, there are so many –
I'll tease it. I'll let you think about it for a second. First, I'll hit a sponsor. Scribd. That's right. With so much content out there, you might spend as much time looking for your next book as reading it. Scribd, instant access to millions of ebooks, audiobooks, magazines, and more. Plus, thoughtfully curated editor's picks and smart recommendations based on what you've read. All for just $9.99 a month. Streaming changed everything. We used to flip around TV channels and look for something interesting. Now we just pick from thousands of great options. Scribd does that for books. Wired and Forbes calls it the Netflix for books. I have all my books on Scribd, and you should check out some of them because I'm told they're funny. Scribd, am I right, Dawson?
Right now, Scribd is offering our listeners a free 60-day trial. Go to try.scribd.com/Adam for your free trial. That's try.scribd.com/Adam to get 60 days of Scribd for free.
Well, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Jay Leno and some of the comedians he loves right after this. Hey, it's Adam Carolla.
It's Mark Garagos.
We do a show called Reasonable Doubt.
Best hour in the universe.
Sometimes 54 minutes.
And sometimes we've been known to do 48 minutes as well, and sometimes an hour six.
Either way, we round up. Best hour. Like Mark Bill.
It's exactly like in 6-minute intervals. Exactly.
Every Saturday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Subscribe to Reasonable Doubt, the best hour in the universe. With Mark Garagos and Adam Carolla. Every Saturday on Podcast One, Carolla Digital, and Apple Podcasts.
All right, back with the great Jay Leno, who I must say is Hold Me Famously. It doesn't have to be difficult. And it's just one of the easiest guys in Hollywood, most generous guys in Hollywood. But I think it's a little of the low self-esteem that bleeds through, which I like. I feel like I have low self-esteem. Yeah. Maybe everyone thinks they have low self-esteem, but really don't.
No, how many people do you meet who just think they're unbelievable? People just think they're
I guess
great.
There's a lot of that. And I
mean, I know comedians. I'm not going to say who they are. I'll tell you, they're the greatest comic in the world. I mean, there's nobody funnier than them. And you go, oh, no, yeah, good. No, I am. Yeah, I mean, they just, I mean, you go, wow, okay, this is really awesome.
Well, I think you also have to realize that you're Jay Leno and you're in a certain position. And I think people may want you to anoint them or may want your blessing somehow because you do have a legendary status in the industry. So you're probably – I know you have low self-esteem. It's hard to digest. But people are going to come up to you and try to get you to validate them.
I mean, ultimately, you're only as funny as your last joke. Like I enjoy working flappers here in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working with – a younger generation of comics, probably never even, I mean, they might know you from The Tonight Show, but they were maybe 14 when I left. You know, it's 8 years now. You know, so they're kind of like, and they're surprised that you're funny. You know, they're like, oh, they expect you to do old guy stuff. I don't know what it is, but there's that. And, I, you know, we were the same way when we started out. You know, older comics, you thought, oh, what could they be like? And they, oh, well, they really are good, you know.
Well, that this brings me to a point, which is being so Jay was, at least from the cheap seats, Jay was the comedian's comedian. He was the young guy to go on Letterman and destroy. And it was Jay Leno, Jay Leno, Jay Leno. At some point, you became the man. And we have a weird relationship with the man as it pertains to comedy. It's right. Sort of... If you start, and it was a little different because we don't, it's not quite the same with guys like Dave Chappelle, but at some point, if you started playing big venues and you became a sellout or you got on the Tonight Show, now you're selling out,
you're not keeping
it real with the artist. And it strikes me that you went from, the comedian's comedian to the man.
Mm-hmm.
And people were kind of shitty with it sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Please. Yeah. Yeah. This is, look, when you're playing football, who do you tackle? The guy with the ball.
Right.
That's pretty much the way it is. I mean, I was the same way when, before you make it, how'd that guy get it? You know, you have that in the back of your mind. Then you get there and you go, oh, this is how it is. I get it. You know, like I find now it's like, when you do an interview with a journalist, I don't answer the question. I break my silence. Leno breaks his silence. Mm-hmm. I wonder why I have a silence. I've been talking for an hour. I don't think, you know, or Leno lashes out. I go, I didn't lash out. The guy asked me a question. I gave a perfectly reasonable answer. You know, it just always makes me laugh. So you just learn how to. You know, I don't believe the good stuff, and I don't believe the bad stuff. I just take it, oh, that's right. Well, thank you. That's very nice. You know, when I left for The Tonight Show, I walked out the door on Thursday, and Friday I did four nights in Florida. I gave the next night. I didn't take stuff off the wall. I didn't take pictures and things. It was a job. I worked there for 22 years. I loved it. I enjoyed the people I worked with. But I didn't, you know, here's Hollywood. Don't marry a hooker, okay? Because ultimately it'll break your heart. So, you know, I got the same wife. I got the same car, my 55 Buick. I have the same friends I had in high school. And I go through life with that. I don't shoot for happiness. I shoot for content. I'm content because happiness is like – it's like champagne. If you drink it every day, now you're a raging alcoholic. You're not enjoying it at all. So I shoot for contentment. At the end of the week I go – no, I was pretty happy on Wednesday. I think Wednesday was a good day. I did this. I did my wife and I went here or whatever it might be. You know, I mean, the best day of your life is the day before that horrible thing happened.
Right.
You know, every time I think of like this horrible thing with Travis Scott and Alec Baldwin and you go, the best day of his life was the day before that happened.
Right.
Now your life has changed immeasurably.
Which essentially is every day for us if that thing doesn't happen.
Right,
so recognize
right, right.
it. Or
that's
at
what
least
I mean. That's why
it.
I enjoy every day. Nothing terrible. This is fine, you know?
I'm smiling because when I went and saw you at the Universal Amphitheater in 86. That early.
Yeah, 86. Yeah.
I saw you at the Universal Amphitheater, and you had a whole bit about your 55 Buick.
Right, right.
And how big it was.
Right, right.
And I'm going to screw the joke up, but you'd have to go under the fenders and clean off the Volkswagens that you ran over.
No, the idea was you hit it in the dash, they hose it off and sell it to somebody else.
That was right. That the big metal dash.
Yeah, right.
But there's also running over cars or something. There was a joke about that.
The car was so big there was no radio. Live acts. We brought live acts in.
That's right.
Just stuff. It's just it was stupid. It's stupid.
Do you look back on your stuff and wince sometimes?
Well, I think everybody does, don't you?
Oh, they do. Everybody does. Yeah.
Yeah. I was getting beat up for a while for not apologizing for Monica Lewinsky jokes. I go, well, I told them in period. Mm-hmm. As they were happening, the whole country was talking about this, and we did jokes about it. Okay. I mean, 35 years later, am I supposed to apologize for that? I don't know. I don't think I did anything terribly wrong. I saw the events of the day, and I commented on them, and that's as everybody else did at the time. So that's the age we live in now.
Do you feel like – and I guess it's something comedians have to kind of wrestle with a little bit, which is do you feel like you're a better comedian now than you were 30 years ago? Do you feel like you're learning something? And not every day, but I just mean sort of growing, refining. I mean, I was up on stage with you. You're sharp and fast and funny. I think people think sometimes people think of comedy like professional sports, like, well, he's getting past his prime now. He's not – you don't have any signs of that. But I'm just saying, internally?
That can happen. It's funny when – the real test for me is when I watch old monologues. Because you did 4,631 Tonight Shows. So you can't remember – and when you hear jokes that – I'm hearing them for the first time.
Yeah, I have no recollection.
I have no recollection of the joke, and I laugh out loud because I don't laugh at my own stuff. But if they don't remember it, and I go, "Oh, that was I could tell that joke today." You know, this one.
Yeah, it's sort of like
here's one that was like
looking
like that.
He's looking back at an old picture yourself, right, and going, "No, I was pretty good looking back then." You can't say it in real time,
pompous ass.
But go ahead.
Right, right. No, the joke was. I remember the joke. About a kid in China was born with the vestiges of a third eye. He didn't have a third eye, but the vestiges of a third eye. And today, lens crafters said they can make him glasses in about an hour and a half. And I love that joke. That was another. Another one was I'd done a gig in – because I saw myself telling this on a rerun. Carson was showing reruns. And I didn't remember what the punchline was. And it was that I was doing a gig in Alaska. I took this gig in Alaska in February. And I'm in my hotel, and the sun comes up at like 11:30 in the morning and then goes down at 1:30 after. It's only up for 2 hours. It's 50 degrees below zero. I put on my coat. I'm in this hotel room, and the hotel has that thick glass, like urinal glass, like in a subway. It's light in, but you can't see anything. So I'm just going to go out. So I go out. I go to the thrifty drugstore, and the ice cream is still soft. I don't understand how that can happen, you know. And I said, I didn't see that coming in. Oh, that's a pretty good joke. I could do that joke now. That's a good joke. So, yeah, I mean, obviously you see ones where you go, ooh, you can't do that anymore this because it's sexist or whatever. But, so I'm not sure what the question was.
Well, do you find yourself, growing or feel like,
here's one you
Tom Brady is better, arguably, at 44 than he was at 24, or not even arguably. He's just better at 44.
Right.
Now,
But not faster.
Not faster, but...
But better.
And, you know, common wisdom is you're out of the league by the time you're 33.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's defied that.
Right.
Do you feel stronger now as a comedian than you did when you were 44?
Yeah, I mean, comedy's like golf. You can do it till you're 75 or 80 if you play it right. But to me, real growth for a comedian, because all comedians start out with jokes, and you do those. And then we would go down to Cantor's or Theodore's or any one of these popular spots when we were kids, comedians, rather young comedians, and we'd sit and we'd tell stories. And then one day I said, I'm just going to tell that story that I told at the table on stage. It didn't have really a beginning or an end. It was just a story. And, oh, the people laughed. And I said, oh, all I really need for this is a punchline. And nobody can steal this because it's my story. It happened to me as opposed to two guys going to a bar and this, you know, whatever.
Right.
So to me, that was always the real growth when something can happen in your life. Chappelle does that very well, you know, and you just tell the story of what happened in your life. And because of your natural ability and your ability to be a storyteller, it works, you know, and you go, that's the real growth as a comedian when it becomes so you. People, that's an Adam Carolla kind of story or whatever it might be.
So you do feel yourself getting stronger as the years.
Yeah, you know, I'm really enjoying it now because at this point you meet people who used to watch you when they were like seven.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I saw you on, you know, when you were a magical figure on TV to them as a kid. And it always makes me laugh, you know, when you go to do a radio show, the legendary, it makes me laugh. I find it very humorous.
Do you have any religion? Are you religious at all?
No, not at all.
Is that so you're kind of an enigma to me because you come from this family and the family feels very traditional.
Oh, it is very traditional. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't gamble.
There's a dumb joke that goes that way, by the way. But
what's the joke? What's the joke?
It's it's from when I was 10.
Yeah.
It wasn't my joke.
Go ahead, yeah.
It was, I don't drink, I don't cuss, I don't smoke. God damn it, I left my cigarettes at the bar.
Right.
Funny when you're not. Right. So you're very traditional that way, but you're not religious. You don't have kids of your own. Like, there's parts of you that feel non-traditional. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think the real key to being a comedian is you don't fit in anywhere.
As far as being classified.
No, just you don't fit in. You know, I remember seeing the movie The Friends of Eddie Coyle with Robert Mitchum. Have you ever heard that movie? Well,
no,
there's a movie. It takes place in
Massachusetts. The one you did with Pat Morita.
No. This takes place in Massachusetts. And I thought, ooh, a movie takes place in Massachusetts.
What year was the movie?
Oh, it's probably in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But Robert Mitchum's sitting there with his old gang that planned a bank job.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting there, he's holding the beer, and he's going, this is great, isn't it? Beer, steaks on the grill, wives are talking, kids are playing. How do we get the hell out of here? I mean, I said, that was me. I was living in Massachusetts. Wonderful parents, nice house. So why am I fidgeting? Why is this? And I thought, I just remember that line from the movie. They were going to go rob a bank because, ooh, it was exciting.
Right.
You know? And I thought, ooh, that's kind of cool. I mean, when I lived in Massachusetts, I was lazy, dyslexic, terrible student. I come here, suddenly I'm the hardest working person. People, I don't know where that came from, but you grow up in New England with that work ethic, what are you going to sit by the pool? Is that what you're going to do? Really got nothing to do? You know, and you come here and then suddenly, it works to your advantage, you know?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. And maybe you feel this way. My friend Dennis Prager always says, he's a very hardworking guy. And he says, because there's a lazy person essentially living inside of it.
Right.
He's fighting it. He's overcompensating. Right. And I used to feel very lazy as well. I was lazy. I didn't know what to do, so that just made for lethargy, because it's like saying, I don't know what direction to go, so you can't hike the trail.
Right.
If you don't start down it, then people say, well, you got a bad knee, and you go, no, I could probably hike for 10 miles if if I could find a direction to hike in.
Right.
I just kind of knew what I didn't want to do from working at McDonald's and digging ditches and stuff like that. But I do feel like there's a lazy old version of me in me that I'm trying to overcompensate for.
I am exactly the same way. I go, I should be doing more. You know, I whenever I have free time, I go, really? So what are you doing now? Nothing. I'm just sitting here. You know, I should be coming up with more material. I should be doing something, you know.
Yeah, and I think maybe part of that mindset is not becoming too enamored or reflective about your past success.
No, I'm not at all. I mean, you're as good as your last joke. That's what I – when I go to the Flappers Comedy Club, I don't go on as a former host of the Tonight Show. You know, I follow a half a dozen other people, you know, some brand new. I don't need the headline. I just want to get up and try my jokes, see if they work. And people, oh, okay. And this way you get a real sense of where you are. It's not – like even when I go on the Tonight Show or something with Fallon, I always go on with a set. I don't go on as, you know, on my day when we did the show, you know.
Right.
Nobody cares. They don't care. You know, that's what I loved about Rodney Dangerfield. Rodney, I loved, he never knew his politics, didn't know anything. He always had jokes. Rodney never sat down and went, yeah, things are good. I'm taking it easier now. You know, he always had funny jokes. Did I ever tell my Rodney thing at his funeral? Did I ever tell you this?
No. Or maybe,
tell me again.
That's
my favorite thing. You know, I had Rodney on The Tonight Show in 2004. 2005, I guess it was. And he seemed off. You know, when you know a comic, you know their movements. Oh, I tell you, you know, Rodney's got all. And the hand didn't go all the way up like it normally did. You know,
the time.
Yeah,
right.
And did, you know, he did fine, but he seemed a little off. So I said to Deb, I said, well, he's doing the same. I said, I think Rodney's having a
stroke. That was your longtime producer over there?
Yeah, Debbie Vickers, yeah.
Right.
I said, I think Rodney's having a stroke. Call a paramedic. She goes, why don't you? I go, I think he's having a stroke. He's sweating more. I said, I know his act, and he just seems not off, but different. You know, okay. So he called the paramedic side, and Rodney sits down. And he's funny. And the show ends. He's in the dressing room now, and the paramedics show up, and they go, he had a stroke. I go, he did have a stroke. Okay. So I take Rodney away. Okay. And then he came back from that room. But then he had a massive stroke, and he was in a coma. And I went to the hospital, and Joan called me and said, oh, Rodney's in a coma.
So his wife?
Yeah. So
his younger wife who had the big flower.
You know something?
Business.
Great lady.
Yeah.
She loves that guy like this is the woman you want to love. I mean, because I think everybody's thing with his Rodney, with his beautiful woman, you go, no. I mean, she worshipped him. You know, she started the Rodney after he died, the Rodney Foundation,
right.
And I mean, really, just a nice, nice woman, and someone you'd want. You know, I can't imagine not wanting someone like her. You know, anyway, so Rodney's lying there in a coma, and Joan says to me, "Jay, he's in a coma, but I think he can understand what we're saying, but he can't respond." So I said, "Oh," so she said, "Jay, put your finger in Rodney's hand." So I put my finger in Rodney's hand, and she goes, Rodney, if you know it's Jay, just try and squeeze his finger, any movement at all. So I feel just a little bit of a squeeze, and I whisper in Rodney's ear. I go, Rodney, that's not my finger. You know? You know? And Rodney, and he did a jump. You know, like,
really?
Like, you know, like if you hit somebody with a taser, they go like this. And Joe went, oh, yeah, he laughed. I think he's laughing. It sounds selfish, but I made Rodney laugh one last time. I mean, I think he enjoyed it, and he died right after that.
Wow.
And it was really sad. But he was a comic to the end, you know. And it was just, it was so touching, and he was great. He was a great comic, always had jokes. He never relied on, I'm just going to go out and be me. He knows you're only as good as the material you have, so it's a good lesson for comics. Always be prepared. You know, a lot of times I'll go to Flappers and I'll see young comics and they'll do a different set than they did the night before, but not get many laughs. And I go, you know, this is Hollywood. You don't know who's in the audience. It could be a casting director. If you're in Des Moines, break your material in there. Okay, you don't know who's in the crowd here. Do the best you can do and tighten it and tighten it and tighten it. And even if it's down to 4 minutes, it'll be a really funny 4 minutes.
I think for you, and it's kind of the same, I have the same feeling, which is I think sometimes people, I notice this in radio, so not so much with TV because you have a big in-studio live audience.
Right.
The radio, there's no live audience.
Right.
And so sometimes comedians, again, put them in front of the crowd, everyone kind of straightens up
right.
and tells their jokes.
Right.
Go to a radio, well, you know, club holds 300 people, but you may have 750,000 people listening,
right.
but nobody in the club.
Right.
But the microphone goes to all the cars, which are all small clubs
right.
and people out there driving. Right. And people would come in and kind of mail it in. You know, they were half-cocked. They were tired.
Right,
you
right,
know,
right.
you could tell they didn't really want to be there.
Right, right.
And I would always kind of go, these mics are hooked up. You know, there's people out there.
I know,
and
I
if
know.
if you would burn the calories for the 250 people in the club, then do the math because we have 250,000 people
right.
that are listening.
Right, right.
And I always felt the same way, which is if I'm going to go on somebody's show, I think a lot of people go, well, it's the Tonight Show. I'm going to show up, you know. But this cable show I've never heard of, like Who Cares, or the
right.
local radio show I'm phoning into. My thing is just have one mode. And I notice you're that way, which is like have one mode. If you agree to it, show up and burn some calories and be funny.
Yeah. Give it a shot. Although it wasn't that funny today. But yes, yes.
But you are interesting and engaging and always funny, Jay Leno. I should point out that you should definitely check out Jay Leno's Garage as well, which is on CNBC.
We're also on YouTube,
and
too.
And on YouTube as well. And his amazing car care products, which are flying off the shelves.
Yeah, those have done really well.
And we're
and we developed those ourselves. We didn't just take a check and put our name on somebody else's product.
And, of course, YouBetYourLife.com is where you can go to find out where You Bet Your Life is going to be airing near you and in your town. Jay, always a pleasure. What
Thank
can
you,
I
my
say?
Friend.
I'm always glad to talk to you.
Well, we had fun the other night. I enjoyed being on stage with you. That was great.
And you stole the show, and you showed once again why, even if you're uncomfortable with the title, people say legend before they bring Jay Leno
out. Thank you very much.
So, you can go to adamcarolla.com for all my live shows. Until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Jay Leno. Oh, yeah. Oh, and, who came on before that?
Papa John
saying mahala.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Get your tickets to see the Ace Man. He's everywhere, and we'll sell out at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com. RockAuto.com. Why spend 30 to 50%, even 100% more for the same parts that a chain store or dealership might have? Why spend so much there? Why not go to rockauto.com? It's a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. Go to rockauto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Everything from engine control modules to brakes to motor oil, even new carpet. Whether it's for your classic car or your daily driver, get everything you need in a few clicks delivered direct to your door. Go to rockauto.com. See all the parts available for your car or your truck. Write Carolla in the How Did You Hear About Us? So that is Carolla, C-A-R-O-L-L-A, in the How Did You Hear About Us box. So they know we sent you. An amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. RockAuto.com.
Gearheads know that some projects need so many parts, it feels like you need a whole storage unit just to store them. That's what eBay Motors' 122 million parts are for. Think of it as your virtual parts garage. They've always got the right fitment at the right prices. Use the eBay Motors app or visit ebaymotors.com. Let's ride.
Welcome back, Bayside!
Streaming only on Peacock.
Can't wait to start junior year.
Saved by the Bell is back.
This is gonna be awesome!
And taking school spirit?
Our rivals just destroyed our mascot.
We're gonna crush Valley.
To the max.
If we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat it.
That's why we have all these reboots of teen shows from the 90s. Get a new idea, Hollywood.
Saved by the Bell. New season streaming now.
Let's do this, baby.
Only on Peacock.